Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn on what you want, like trying out that new workout class, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like a foam roller for your sore muscles. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
All right, welcome to Bet the Edge. I'm Jay Crouch here with Trudinsik. We're recording late Sunday evening. Today we're going to talk a little NFL, the draft, initial markets in Offensive Rookie of the Year and Defensive Rookie of the Year, and then we will talk NBA the rest of the way. But let's start with the draft. Drew, what were the biggest takeaways for you from a, I guess, mainly a betting perspective?
So from a betting perspective, I took a bath. It was a bad draft for me, and that's embarrassing because it's an information game, and you know, the idea of losing on an information draft is you know, an information market is it's tough to swallow. And I did everything I could not to tilt over the weekend. I actually had a lovely weekend, just kind of, you know, divorced from sports betting for to a degree, because I'm like very much in the tilt mode, and so I was very much not inclined to be like, you know what. Let's win it all back. Let's lay it with the Celtics. Let's go. And you know, so rather than, you know, kind of get myself into trouble, I enjoyed beautiful weather here in Long Beach. We had the Congressional Cup sailing racing come through, which was spectacular. Perfect conditions for it. We had IndyCar racing last week, sailing racing this week, and then we'll be in Kentucky this week for horse racing. So it's just been kind of a nice, perfect little trifecta of racing in this part of the season. But that's okay. The draft itself. You know, I go from a betting perspective again, like my info was bad. My high confidence stuff didn't come through. In hindsight, expecting teams at the end of round one to go for wide receivers was likely, but expecting guys like, you know, Ricky Pearsall to go with, you know, was in the round one was a surprise. It was bad reads for me all the way around. And I probably needed to get more, you know, involved more, sincerely earlier in the process to try to understand exactly how it would go, because, you know, top five picks went pretty chalky. And at the end of the day, like, there was no wild uncertainty. There was no huge long shots that came through. It was just kind of cooler heads prevailed, and what we kind of expected to be the most likely outcome came through. And that's fine. And, you know, I'm going to have to, you know, kind of really do some hard reflections on this with some space. But that said, from like a betting perspective for the NFL, it feels like the rich got richer, Jay. We have a whole slew of teams that are just seem to be wildly mismanaged at the bottom of the NFL. And then we have this kind of, you know, kind of contingent of, you know, perennial contenders that landed some top tier talent for kind of, you know, continuing to build their advantage. And I would say that, you know, the clear and obvious winners of the draft are the Bears. Duh. They got the best quarterback and then a bunch of other really good pieces. That is a team that is looks, you know, that is built to win now, albeit they are in a very, very competitive division. And then you have like the other end of the spectrum with the Chiefs, where it's like, wow, these rosters that the Chiefs are facing in the AFC West are flawed. And some of the decisions made by those teams not to, you know, kind of sincerely address the wide receiver position outside of Ladd McConkey for the, you know, for the Chargers, I'm scratching my head about decisions for the Broncos to swing on Bo Nix at pick 12 was a wild one, considering how many holes are on that roster. And then the Raiders, I kind of just don't really get what's going on there. Taking a tight end, which felt like a luxury considering you put high end draft capital into Mayer last year, and you are, you know, kind of leaving a lot of parts of your roster unaddressed was pretty strange. And so, you know, I don't come out of this feeling like there's a big sea change here, a big shift in power. It feels pretty clearly to me like, you know, you have a handful of very well-run franchises and then a lot of franchises that are floundering. And, you know, I have no better example than look at the NFC South. What is this division? Like, are Bucks just going to win this for the next 10 years? Like, I do not get, you know, the losers of the draft in my mind pretty clearly were Terry Fontenot for his decision-making in round one. And Dave Tepper for the way that he's managing the Panthers. I don't get it. Like, this doesn't look like, you know, the way to deal with, you know, how you stock a roster in today's NFL. I think ultimately, you know, there's a pretty clear divide between the haves and the have nots right now. And it starts at the top.
Yeah. I think just talking about the draft betting generally, I don't know if it was because I was just paying more attention this year, but I know you don't do this, but I'm just stunned by how many people they bet off of their own personal evaluations of a player. It's like, it doesn't matter if you're saying that Michael Penix is going to go not in the first round because you don't think he's a good quarterback, like that's just completely irrelevant. Like, you just need to be betting off of what the league thinks. And the way to ascertain what the league thinks, one, the easiest way to do it is by having your own sources. The second easiest way to do it, and it's kind of a hack way, but you'll, for the most part, I think, profit off of the draft if you're just going off of massive market disparities to consensus mock drafts from guys proven historically to be pretty strong in that department. But yeah, I was stunned that it's like, you just need to know what the league thinks of someone versus, like, yeah, I wouldn't have drafted Saquon Barkley second overall, but it doesn't matter. Like, it's completely irrelevant, like, what I would think of something. Like, I would have voted Bogdanovic sixth man of the year. It doesn't matter. I'm not going to bet on him because that's my opinion. Like, you just need to go with what is going to win the bet. And so that was, I thought, pretty stark. And then the other thing too, which is maybe if you don't have league sources, the easiest way to win on the draft is just by betting logical inconsistencies in markets. And I tweeted this out, but like Drake May to go three was steaming off the map late Thursday, but JJ McCarthy over 5.5 was just like doing nothing. It's like, what? How does that work? Like, those things are extremely correlated, because if Drake May goes three, then 4 and 5 have Kyler Murray and Justin Herbert. So you're banking on a trade at that point. And like, that's a lot to bank on when you're taking -110 on an under or whatever. So those type of things popped up. But the draft, really, the exercise of betting it is to have an opinion that you're confident in because it's backed by information or logical inconsistency or whatever, and then being able to bet all of the dominoes off of that. So if you were really confident that Drake May was going three, and that the league had not so high of an opinion of JJ McCarthy, then there were all these other ripple effects off of that that you could bet. And so, I mean, that is the way into these markets. People really love the draft in a way that is, when it's, maybe it's Australian and there's no draft that's a super big deal in Australia. But yeah, it kind of baffles me at the interest level in terms of betting the draft when limits are like relatively small. But that would be my advice for people who do bet the draft.
Yeah, I would also say that the as far as an entertainment product goes, this was a huge flop. Like, my goodness, it was a tough watch. It was, I did not get the drama part of it this year really at all. This might be the last draft where I'm really taking, you know, especially seriously and from a betting perspective. I don't know. What were some of your takeaways when it comes, you know, as far as just like the team decision making and team building and like the way that some of these, you know, particular these organizations are kind of approaching, you know, how to roster their squads for 2024?
I think you just reinforce something that, like, whenever I talk to people around the league, it's a favorite question I probably would ask everyone I know works in the league or around it. Like, who are the most well-run organizations? And every single time, the answer is the Eagles and the Ravens. And those two teams are just head and shoulders above everyone else. And I think that's probably reflected again in their drafts. The Ravens getting Nate Wiggins late. The Eagles getting Quinyon Mitchell and Cooper DeJean. Mitchell, who could have, like, if he went 8 to the Falcons, I don't think anyone would have been that surprised. And the Eagles get him later in the first round and shore up significant need. And I think the Eagles have just overall had a really strong offseason. Their season is going to come down to, like, did something break with Jalen Hurts last season as a quarterback, or was that just the weird back end of the year and he's fine? So, yeah, I lean that he's probably fine and they're going to be a force again. And then the other team just sneakily is Detroit, who I thought had a really strong draft. They get Terry and Arnold. They shore up at cornerback, which was probably the biggest weakness on the team. And now all of a sudden, like, the offense is loaded, with the offensive line being top 2-3 unit in football. You have Amon-Ra St. Brown, a top 6-7 wide receiver, and you have Goff, who is going to only have to go outdoors, I think, 3-4 times next year again. And then the defense, which I think will be much improved. So I think I'm going to be pretty high on the Lions relative to maybe other people's opinions. But those would be the two teams that immediately leap out, the Eagles and Lions.
Yeah, I mean, the line. I agree with you on the Lions, except for the fact that, like, the Packers did pretty well. The Bears did very well.
Loaded division. Because,
yeah, it's a loaded division now, it seems likely they're gonna, you know, kind of ink Goff to a long term deal. At least that's sort of the writing on the wall. Don't feel super about that, but okay, like, he was fine. You just have to do it. I don't really know what to make of Minnesota right now. Obviously everyone besides Caleb Williams in the draft, I think JJ McCarthy landed in the most favorable spot by margin. He has weapons to work with. He has an offensive line that's elite, and he has a scheme and a system and a play caller that I believe in being able to develop him. But at the same time, like, you know, we're going to get to this in a second. When we're talking offensive rookie of the year, like, is he going to beat out Sam Darnold for the QB1 on week one? Not obviously. So I think it's but that, you know, all that said, the NFC North all of a sudden looks like an absolute monster of a division. Like, honestly, in the AFC, like, is it clear to you who the second best team in is right now after the Chiefs? And is the gap as big as it seems? Because, like, the Chiefs to me look like the very clear, obvious winners of their division. And everyone else who, you know, I kind of held up, they're either in a little bit of a dogfight because there's other good teams, and Chiefs getting the one in the AFC seems kind of a foregone conclusion at this point.
Yeah. To me, the sneakiest little thing about the NFL season, which is going to materialize as we progress through the 2025 season, is that Joe Burrow has a fourth place schedule. And I think that might end up being a big deal, where the Ravens obviously have a first place schedule. And with Burrow, that team, which, I mean, you just kind of forget that they finished last in the division because the Ravens, Browns, and Steelers obviously made the playoffs, and the Bengals were fighting at the end. But with Burrow out, they ultimately miss out. And as a result of that, they get three very favorable matchups relative to the Ravens in their games. Which is, I think, basically worth, like, at least another full win in terms of your expectations for the Bengals. So I don't know. Like, are they the second best team? Like, I'd still take Baltimore as the second best team. They're probably just better. But it does seem like there is a little bit of a gulf, not necessarily in, like, overall talent, but just because you have the Bengals and the Ravens and the Browns, who could also be up there. You have them in one division, and then you have the Chiefs with the Raiders and Broncos both looking fairly unserious in terms of competing, and then the Chargers, who may be somewhat serious but don't have wide receivers, and the defense is still unproven. So certainly looks like the Chiefs for now is the clear number one, as they are basically every year. Let's talk about offensive rookie of the year, where Caleb Williams is plus 200. Makes sense. The most talented player, quarterback in the draft. He has a ton of weapons now with Roma Dunze added to DJ Moore and Keenan Allen, an improving offensive line. He plays in a massive market and a team that's going to get a ton of attention, and a team that should probably just be good straight away. Like, I imagine the Bears, their win total is, I believe, 8.5, 9. So the expectations are good. Everything falls into place for Caleb Williams to be the favorite. If you look further down the board, Marvin Harrison Jr. plus 600, JJ McCarthy plus 850, Jaden Daniels, Malik Nabers, and Xavier Worthy are next. Does anyone look particularly appetizing to you?
I think there are a number of players you can pretty much put a line through. And I'll start with Drake May, even though I like that pick for the Patriots aren't really going anywhere. And I think with some of the limitations in the skill position group on that roster, I think expecting, you know, a huge rookie campaign for May is foolish. So let's put a line through him. I think you put a line through Roma Dunze because of the synergy between him and Caleb Williams. Like, if Roma Dunze really does blow up statistically, Caleb Williams is, you know, the beneficiary of that as well. And the Bears are winning games, and so he's just going to win. I'm fine putting a line through Xavier Worthy. I think he's still a pretty raw product. And I know that, you know, adding speed to the Chiefs is exciting. Surely he could be a difference maker in terms of a championship pursuit, but expecting him to be a regular contributor and, you know, just sort of the guy for the Chiefs offense is foolish. So putting a line through him. I think Malik Nabers is in trouble because I don't exactly know who's throwing him the ball. And I think, you know, I'm fine putting a line through JJ McCarthy at price because, again, we don't really know if he's going to get the starting spot. I'm fine putting a line through Bo Nix for all the same reasons as Drake May. And then everybody down the board outside of Keon Coleman, I think, is probably fairly priced or just a little bit short of what is fair. So they all get lines. And Keon Coleman's interesting because he has the potential to actually be the guy for the Buffalo Bills just because of how, you know, just, I don't know, is the Buffalo Bills offense is really going to go through the tight end this year, really, like the passing offense? Keon should be able to, you know, be able to rack up a pretty impressive amount of volume for, you know, a rookie. So he may be in the mix, but it's going to be tough to jump a quarterback, and it's going to be tough to beat out the guys at the top of this list. And, you know, I look at Caleb Williams, Marvin Harrison Jr., and Jaden Daniels as probably the three most likely winners. And I think ultimately, if I had to take a price, probably considering Daniels, because you're right, the Eagles did phenomenally well. They might be the dominant team in the NFC East this year. But Jaden Daniels at least has sort of a, you know, a little bit more of, you know, he's got a release valve of his athleticism and what he can do on the ground that I think does tend to help rookie quarterbacks put up a more impressive profile overall. For what it's worth, it seems like the Washington Commanders are at least being well managed. And they have now kind of an interesting roster. So I don't have high confidence in this at all. But if you made me take a price of any of the three guys who I think are most likely to win between Caleb, Marvin, and Daniels, I guess I'm taking Daniels just because he's 9-1 and he's the highest. Do you have a strong conviction on anyone here?
I don't. I think the good thing with Daniels is that, you know, as we saw in winning the Heisman, is that if he plays well, it is very loud statistically. Like, yeah, he's right, going to accumulate a ton of stats, whereas if, like, Bo Nix plays well, it may not be as loud on a team that's likely not going to make the playoffs, and he's just not going to have the explosive numbers you would think that Jaden Daniels has. So, like, I think the thing here is, like, there are a lot of pretty strong candidates. Like, we're talking about, like, Malik Nabers and Roma Dunze are like write-offs. Like, they would be very strong candidates in other years. And you've got, to me, the most interesting guy in a way is McCarthy, just because opinions on him are so divisive across the league. Like, some people think that he's just no good. Like, he's just not going to be a good quarterback. And then there are other people who think that, you know, he has extraordinary talent and could be very good from day one. And he's in an amazing context, to your point earlier, where he has Justin Jefferson, Jordan Addison, TJ Hawkinson, if he can come back, great offensive line, great offensive coach in Kevin O'Connell. Like, it's all there for JJ if he's good. It's just there's huge disagreement on whether he's going to be good or not. And so I think this is mostly a wait and see. Agree, Keon Coleman 50-1. Like Ricky Pearsall surely just can't win Offensive Rookie of the Year. Why does he have shorter odds than Keon Coleman? Ricky Pearsall might be wide receiver 4 on his own team.
Likely at this point.
Yeah. So I think this is a bit more of a monitor. Hope that Caleb Williams throws 6 interceptions the first 2 weeks of the season and the market overreacts. But there are a lot. This feels like a stronger field than most years, and perhaps that's not unreasonable given that the first 14 picks of the draft.
They 14 picks were off.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go defense.
Well, I guess real quick on Caleb Williams, like, what's your temperature there?
I think he's going to be really good. Right? And
In year one.
I think so. I don't think he's going to be CJ Stroud, but I think that he is going to be good, and he has a very strong infrastructure, at least in terms of talent. Not sure about the Bears coaching, offensively, at least.
Shane Waldron.
He got
Geno Smith comeback player of the year.
True. He did get that done. But, I mean, I don't think there's really any reason to doubt Caleb. He's the consensus best quarterback in the draft. I don't know if you want to get generational talent, like probably not in the Andrew Luck, Trevor Lawrence type of sphere of buzz coming in, but just with the amount of weapons that he has, like what kind of rookie quarterback is able to get Rome Odunze, DJ Moore, and Keenan Allen, and then what projects as like a top 7 or 8 defense as well on the other side? I think he warrants his price.
Yeah, it's a really good offensive line too, and maybe one of the issues, at least if you want, you know, the people who are a little bit throwing shade on Caleb through this process were, I think, kind of hesitant to acknowledge how weak the offensive line was at USC last year, and I'm kind of split on this. Like, it may take him, you know, a little bit of time to kind of find his groove, just because the way that last year was a little bit of a, you know, kind of a dip in terms of his development. But that said, it's hard to think of, a more optimal spot to land in terms of the talent around him. The real huge question is just what are you getting out of Shane Waldron? How does his vision for offense fit with the pieces that are there? Because ultimately it could get there. I don't know. I mean, this team is built to win now. And if he underwhelms in year one, I think, just even like an 8-9 type of season, which, in recent history for the Bears, that's good. Like, it's going to be disappointing. Right. Yeah, exactly. And, so the bar is pretty high for him to clear, which is, I think, maybe why I'm not interested in getting involved at 2-1.
Yep. No, I think that is fair. He is someone who, like, if he has 4 touchdowns and get in week one, like, his price is going to collapse. But I don't think that necessarily means that +200 should be bet, because we don't know if he said, like, he's never taken a snap in the NFL. Like, we just don't know. There is some uncertainty in a pretty strong field. All right, let's go to D-Roy, which is always an interesting market. For people who don't know, this skews heavily to edge rushes. It's not a prerequisite. Sauce Gardner, Marshawn Lattimore have won as cornerbacks somewhat recently, Sauce certainly, but does skew to edge rushes, skews to guys typically who go in the first round as well. And that is largely why Dallas Turner is favorite at +500. Leatu Latu, second favorite, +750. Jared Verse, +800. And then a couple of cornerbacks in Quinyon Mitchell and Terrion Arnold, 9-1 and 10-1. Anything leap out here?
I kind of need to understand a little bit how Latu is going to be used in Indy, because, you know, I think from like who's a polished producer now of the edge rush class, he's got to be the top, right? Like Dallas Turner, I'm fine if you make him the favorite, just because like over the balance of his career, is he likely going to be like, you know, a good producer, particularly if, you know, if, Brian Flores stays in Minnesota. Yes. Like he's going to deliver some results. No question. He's going to put up some production. But I do kind of look at him as a little bit more raw of a prospect. Whereas Latu has, his bag of tricks is fully developed. And it's just a matter of like, he was a little bit of a risky take for the Colts, cause you know, who knows how long he'll be able to play with the injury history he has. That said, they have kind of, he's kind of like, behind a couple of good players. So I'm not exactly sure how much of the field he's going to see. Right now, Ebicom and Quiddipay are the two starting edges for, Gus Bradley defense. And I think Latu is the answer here, but I, at the same time, like, I kind of need to get a better sense of exactly what his role is going to be. I'm fine tossing the corners. It takes corners longer to finally, to get their feet under them. And in particular, because you have guys like Mitchell and Dejean, both landing in Philly, and they're there to take over from, some vets who are kind of getting up there, and I don't know exactly how much playing time they're going to see. And in my opinion, at least, DeRoy is not one where you get involved with long shots, because, people don't really have a strong read on how a defensive player is contributing to a defense being good. And it's most of the time like, well, this guy was a top pick. He put up some counting stats. This defense was better than expected, or they were top 10. Therefore, this is the guy that we're going to vote for. Like, that's kind of the rubric that this gets, kind of shuffled through. And so for those reasons, I can see very clearly the Colts defense. Colts, by the way, who have a very easy schedule. That defense could, surprise people in terms of how good it is. And if Latu ultimately gets some counting stats and some opportunity to shine, then, he's probably the guy. And 750 is a pretty big number for that. Because I'm surprised, honestly, that there's not a little bit more concentration at the top of the board here, considering that I don't know that a lot of the guys past the top three are going to be able to produce much. What's your read?
Yeah, I think what I've been told about Verse is that he is excellent, but not in a way that is going to lend itself to chasing counting stats. Yeah. Like, he's going to be on the field a lot, but run defense doesn't really win this award if you're an edge rusher. I think if I could see the future and see the week one stats for this award, the one that I would most like to see is what Latu's snap count is.
Exactly. Because
if he is like full-time edge rusher displacing one of Ebukam or Quiddipay, then he should be the favorite for the award, because everything indicates that he is the best pure pass rusher. It's just he has a lesser, to your point, he has a more crowded rotation of edges in Indy than Turner does, for instance, in Minnesota, but still a price I would still prefer to back Latu at plus 750 than Turner at plus 500. I will say as well, with this award, one of my biggest bets on an NFL awards market was a couple of years ago, after week two or week three, Sauce Gardner was 18-1 to win DeRoy. And what that kind of reinforced to me is that cornerbacks, because the only real stat that is allowed that they accumulate is an interception. And so if they're not like Sauce, I don't think Sauce had picks in the first couple of weeks. And the Jets didn't have a great start to the season. And it just kind of didn't get absorbed that, oh, Sauce Gardner is like the fourth ranked cornerback on PFF. And he plays in New York and he has a sick nickname, Sauce. And he has, the number four pick. Like, he has a ton of pedigree. He's 18-1 and he should just be the favorite for the award. And so there may be something similar with Quinion Mitchell and Terry and Arnold, where they may be really good out of the gate. And if they don't have a pick, the market may not react appropriately. So that is one thing I'd probably wait on corners. Quinion Mitchell has a ton of narrative if he is actually good, and I think he is going to be good. Everyone I've spoken to said he's the best corner in the draft. He's the first one taken, taken by the Eagles, very smart organization. They probably are pretty confident that he's good, and he may come in and just straight away be cornerback one on a team that may be a one seed in the AFC. So he is compelling, but at 9-1, not ultra compelling.
And you think pretty high confidence he's going to start over Bradbury?
No, I don't know, but if he does, he's got a pathway. I think he's the most talented corner in that room. Bradbury seems done.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think Bradbury might be completely cooked. I think Quinion Mitchell might just be more talented than Darius Slay right now. Like, Slay kind of fell off a little bit as well. So he is someone who's compelling to me, but at price as a non-edge rusher, I'd wait a little bit on Quinion. All right, it's the most exciting 2 minutes in sports, Drew. Don't miss the 150th running of the Kentucky Derby at Churchill Downs. Coverage starts at 2:30 p.m. Eastern this Saturday, only on NBC and Peacock.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn on what you want, like trying out that new workout class, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like a foam roller for your sore muscles. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
All right, let's talk some basketball. Some game four reactions off of Sunday's slate, which caught a good deal of, though missed the early part due to a couple of back-to-back swimming lessons for my daughters and then some serious Serie A and League R sweats that had to take precedence over the first three quarters of Knicks Sixers. But thank you very much to our Stade Brestois, who snuck in a 96-minute winner to beat Rennes 5-4. Lilian Brassier out of nowhere was able to clinch that and secure their Europa League spot. But anyway, let's start with Clippers Mavs, which was the most insane game of the playoffs to date, at least if you look at it holistically as a full game and not just the end of Knicks Sixers game two. But Clippers get up 31, Mavs lead with, 95 seconds to go or whatever. Then Paul George hits a ridiculous three after doing nothing the entire second half. And then James Harden keeps on reining in his floater game. And the Clippers escape. It's 2-2. Mavs still minus 185 favorites in the series, though. What say you, Drew?
Well, first of all, good on you giving your daughter swimming lessons. Hugely important life skill.
I can't things take properly at all.
Yes, it's a hugely important life skill. Gotta teach them young. You're right. Clippers Mavs was the most insane game, and honestly, like it took till game four, second half, for this series to finally wake up. Right? Like it. Right? Do you kind of feel that way? Like the games one and two were such a slog, and then game three was not really competitive, and Kawhi was just so broken, and it didn't feel good or watching it. And then game four, no Kawhi. Paul George was unbelievable in the first half, taking that to a huge lead. Those of us who bet the under who lost were probably like, well, man, like this is another under. Like they're just never going to learn. They're just going to keep hanging these in the 2-10. Well, that was a loser because they're 67 points in the fourth quarter. Anyway, the final throws were phenomenal, very entertaining. And it took until you didn't really get a sense of what either team really kind of had intended. You know, this is who we want to be. This is our plan A. Everything that we had seen till, the closing minutes of this, this particular game felt, like preamble. And the fact that the Clippers were able to perform that effectively, Harden was that good, and that Paul George was able to be as clutch as he was pretty surprising and phenomenal, because Clippers lose this game, series pretty much over. And now we have a 2-2, and this is probably the most likely series, I think, to go seven, unless you want to talk Cavs Magic, which I don't really want to. This is it. This is now a series. This is now a really good matchup. This is probably going to be, the most competitive and compelling of what we have left. And, I think Kyrie Irving was incredible today. His 40 points looked at times effortless, and he had some moments where he was just, impossibly good. And if Luka has even an average shooting night instead of a poor average shooting day instead of a poor shooting day, the Mavericks probably win this one. And, I think it's kind of just going to come down to which of these teams has their two available guys, Paul George and James Harden for the Clippers, Kyrie Irving, Luka Doncic for the Mavs. Like, those two guys need to click for you to win. And I think that's kind of going to determine this one way or the other. I would make this basically a coin flip right now. I think Clippers, you know, if they did not have home court, I would not feel like they have an especially good chance. I'm not expecting to see Kawhi Leonard back at any kind of meaningful, like true Kawhi Leonard strength. There were some glimpses of it in game two, but it's wild that they've won the two games that they've played in this series without him. But it's, you know, and this is maybe hyperbole or just narrative that's not really, doesn't really fit, but for whatever reason, like Paul George is not a great second banana, but when Kawhi's out of the picture, it does feel like he takes more ownership of his role in that offense, and it's good for the Clippers offensively, weirdly. And I think they have some nice matchups that they can kind of get this series to game seven, and whether they win or lose is just going to come down to who's shooting well that day, I think. So too close for me to call. I'm sweating out some Mavericks series bets that I think are going to come down to the wire. Would like Mavericks to win game five, but not especially hopeful considering the inconsistency you're getting from Luka in this series.
Yep. I mean, well, they are 2.5 point favorites in game five, so it's not so dire as a Mavs man. Sure. As well, I'm not that worried about the series. I think that, you know, them being -185 is justified in that, like, the Clippers shot 62% from three in game four. Like, they needed all of them basically to win the game. And I don't think you can project that going forward. They shot 50% from three in game one, the other game they won in the series. Like, I think if you just normalize shooting, the Mavs should be winning these games fairly comfortably with no Kawhi. Like, there's just not that much talent on this Clippers team. Like, there's a lot of Amir Coffey and Terrence Mann going on. Like, Ivica Zubac has been really... Zubac is good. I like Zubac, but he's been a massive part of this series for the Clippers in a way that you wouldn't hope. And yeah, if Harden is going to shoot 5 of 6 from floater range in every fourth quarter, and they're going to shoot 62% from three, then yeah, they're probably going to win the series. But I'm okay going against that. My two concerns about the Mavs is, one, Jason Kidd every game has three choices to make at center, and to my mind he's making the worst choice of the three, where he keeps on closing with Maxi Kleber over Daniel Gafford and Derek Lively. And I think that Kleber is a worse offensive and worse defensive player than both of those guys, and I just don't know what the point of him is. Like, What was the point of him against Harden? Like, he's not providing rim protection. He can't stay in front of him on a switch. So it's like, what are you doing? Like, he's just getting wide open layups and little teardrops. I don't understand what's going on with that with Kidd. Kidd seems to have some weird infatuation with Maxi Kleber, which has spanned years at this point, and I just don't think he's that good. And the advantage that the Mavericks have in this series, is that they're just more athletic than the Clippers. Like, the Clippers are just really slow and plodding. Yeah. And they lose their athleticism if they're binning Lively and Gafford for Kleber. Like, they looked their best in game three when it was, you know, you had Gafford or Lively out there with Derek Jones Jr. and PJ Washington or Dante Exum alongside, you know, Luka and Kyrie. And then all of a sudden it's Luka and Kyrie, who are the two best offensive players in the series. Then you have all this athleticism and defense around them. So, well, how the Clippers going to win? Well, it's easier to win if you just take one of the huge elements out and put Maxi Kleber out there. the second thing is, I'm a bit worried about Luka's knee, because he has kind of sucked for all four games. Like, he just hasn't been good. Even in game three when they won, he shot 7 of 25. He's shooting 26% from three this series, taking more than 12 a game. Like, this is a guy, Luka Doncic shoots 50% from the field in the regular season, and he hasn't topped 42.3% in this series in a game yet. He's shooting 38.6% from the field for the series. Like, I don't know if that is the knee. Like, he did the knee, he hurt his knee in game three, and he wasn't great in games one and two either. So maybe it's just, he's just not playing well, but that would be my main concern, is that, like, Luka Doncic is taking a seat to watch the Kyrie Irving show. It's like, you're Luka Doncic. Yeah. You're going to finish second or third in MVP. You cannot go down to Terrence Mann and Amir Coffey. Like, do something, Luka. Go and win this series.
Yeah. By the way, 14 very important minutes for Mr. Mason Plumlee in this game, which I did not have on my bingo card.
Isn't that good? Like, they shouldn't win this series. They really shouldn't. And they may if Luka doesn't wake up.
Yeah, it's wild. But I don't know. It didn't really feel like the Mavs were really kind of prepared for the Clippers giving them a real shot to start this game. And I don't know. They're just a very tough team, because when it's clicking, it's so good and they look unbeatable. And when, you know, they don't seem to, you know, at times when they lack focus, it's a tough hang. And your points about Maxi Kleber are very fair. 2 years ago, you beat the Suns and you went on a run to the Western Conference Finals because you were going small with Maxi, and, you know, your five out, approach was so effective. Like, you have a different roster right now that has different strengths. Like, tack into that kid. And I kind of assume he'll eventually figure it out, but hopefully it won't be too late for the Mavs. But I don't know, as Mavs series ticket holder, like, I'm not like ready to pull the eject button, right? You know, pull the eject cord right now, but I'm cautiously concerned about what I'm seeing and hopeful that they win game five and they can close this thing out in six. I don't want this to go seven, but
would have been nice if they won game four and just made it a wrap, but now it's a little bit of a sweat. Yeah. Team that did take care of business in game four to make the series 3-1 and move into -900 to win the series, my beloved New York Knicks, who I have to say, Drew, even though they got relegated to not even second screen, they were kind of third screen, which I don't have. I only have two screens, so they won't be watched at all because Starbreast and the other game was Napoli-Roma, which I needed Roma not to win. And they scored a last-minute equalizer, which kind of annoyed me, but it's still a fine result overall. Anyway, the Knicks, just love cheering for this team. I love being on this team. There is something so cathartic about Josh Hart getting offensive rebounds, about like Precious Achiuwa blocking the MVP repeatedly in the fourth quarter, about Deuce McBride just fearlessly bombing these threes. And then obviously Jalen Brunson puts his Superman cape on in game four, 47 and 10. And I think that is, if Brunson's just going to outplay Embiid, then the Sixers are drawing dead. In a given game. And to me, the biggest kind of flip in this series has not so much been around Embiid's health, which has kind of, I guess, stabilized a little bit, though he didn't really do anything in the fourth quarter of game four. But the fact that Brunson, who, the way I describe Brunson's game, it's like a controlled arrhythmia. I don't know if arrhythmia is that the extension of arrhythmic? Well, whatever. But it is like it's controlled, where it always looks off balance, but he is kind of directing that, and he's in control while he's doing that. And then in games one and two, it just felt like arrhythmia. Like, there's no control. He was just off balance, and he just didn't have it. And the past two games, he has located it, and now it seems like he knows exactly what he needs to do. He knows exactly how to go at Embiid. He realized as well at the end of this game, like, he was taking so many step backs in the first two games, and then in this one towards the end, he's like, all right, I'm just going to stutter step, get to the hoop, hits one layup, then gets fouled by Tobias Harris as well, and it feels like he has figured out a way to just score efficiently. And if he's going to score efficiently and they're just going to get every single offensive rebound and play defense as hard as they do, then it seems improbable, certainly, that the Sixers are going to win three straight.
Yeah. Jalen Brunson was incredible today. I don't know what else to say. he took 34 field goals, Jay. He got to the line 11 times. He was everything for the Knicks offensively. Slight hat tip, OG Anunoby, he had some moments in this game which were pretty important, I thought. And credit to the Knicks for kind of getting up and getting into this game, because the Sixers, they controlled game three from wire to wire. It felt like the Knicks kind of expected the refs to be against them and leaned into that, which was not great. It didn't feel great. Like, Knicks, come on, like, play. But it was a non-compete from them in game three. And then it felt like that at times in the first quarter. And you're like, man, like, just, you know, this is a more well-coached team. I know they're, I know they have it, more competitiveness, more fight in them. And then to see it, to see them stand up in the second quarter was awesome. And then down the stretch, fourth quarter was must-watch TV. It was just so intense. It was quintessential playoff basketball. I like your description of Brunson is very fun. I think arrhythmia is like largely just irregularities regarding heartbeat, but it catches to his advantage because he catches his defenders off guard. Like they, you know, he's unpredictable. And that's a huge, positive, at particularly in a playoff setting where you're playing the same opponent over and over and over again. Like as they kind of get a feel for what you want to do, that's a problem. And you can't really predict Brunson as much. And that was awesome that he had that level of a game for the Knicks in this spot. And I think the Knicks are going to be able to get this done pretty handily in game five. I would be surprised if they have to come back to Philly. On Embiid, I will say that I was getting nervous as a Knicks backer because it felt like the longer we go into the series, the more kind of Embiid is just sort of getting fit, right? Like his fitness is just getting, you know, closer to where he was at his peak during this regular season. And that was not to be today. The game, you know, this particular game in the second half, in the fourth quarter, he did not look like a dominant force whatsoever. And the fact that he was up against a physical team that wanted to play, the style of ball that the Knicks play, I think didn't help. And I think, they're in trouble. I don't know that Embiid's got anything left in the tank to be the distinguishing factor in game five. And I think that the rest of the cast of characters that the Sixers are relying on right now are just, it's just wildly inconsistent. I mean, Maxey is who he is. He's an offensive factor, but like, you know, everybody else, Harris, Lowry, I mean, man. Like it felt like there were, if you're a Sixers fan or backer and you were watching some of the critical moments with Lowry out there, you're just like, what, how did this happen? Like why was he the answer? Why is he even being considered as the answer? I think ultimately the lack of production from some of the ancillary pieces about the Sixers is what doomed them, on top of just Embiid not being able to go 44 at 100%. And, it's a bummer because, I like competitive basketball, and this series had a lot of juice, but I think the Knicks are probably going to get this done in five, and I'm relieved because I need to win in a big way.
Yeah. Well, not a bummer for me. I would rather this be the Knicks way, and all the games sucked to watch, but the Knicks were winning. But no, I take your point. I do think they did kind of stumble into something where I'm a big proponent of just close with your best guys, regardless of who is in, you know, who is shooting well to start the fourth quarter, and don't keep Bojan Bogdanovic in to close if he's going off, because there are better players than him on the roster who are more likely to play well in the remainder of the game. But I do think the Knicks found something with that closing lineup they had, which was Brunson, McBride, Hart, Anunoby, and Precious, where it's kind of like the dreamscape of what the Toronto Raptors was supposed to be, where it's like 6'8" guys who are just super athletic and just zooming around all the play. And like the fact that they were able to dominate on the boards, despite Precious Achiuwa, who's what, is he like 6'8"? Like he is their center, but Josh Hart plays like he's 8'4". And they just were able to just get everything. And with having OG on Embiid, I think such a key thing with Embiid in this state is that he is so dependent on defenders kind of making mistakes and just fouling him when they don't need to. And Hartenstein hasn't done a good job of that in this series. Like Hartenstein puts his hands in there way too much. Robinson was a bit better, but also little handsy and is injured at the moment. And just having OG on Embiid down the stretch, like OG is magnificent as a defensive player on a lot of levels, but one of the things he is best at, he just doesn't foul guys. Like he just doesn't bite ever. And he's super strong and he's massive and he's not really quick. He's not quick enough to guard Maxey, really, where, you know, having Deuce McBride on Maxey is a better matchup, I think, than having OG on him in a lot of ways. And just OG being there, but still getting the rim protection from Precious, who is also still, you know, quick enough to guard whoever else needs to be guarded on the perimeter. Like, for that lineup to work, Brunson needs to be a god on offense because there's not much else there. But if Brunson's going to play like this, then the lineup is perfect. And they might have found something with Mr. Achua.
Tiny little comment. It's amazing poetry that Thibodeau is doing it with Nick Nurse's guys to Nick Nurse.
Yeah, this is good. I love it. I love it. I really love this Knicks there. There are teams that haven't even won money on the Knicks yet. They may lose the series, but I will remember this team for a long time if they do get this series done, because they are so fun to cheer for. It is just a team that is just all you want from someone that you bet on, or a team that you bet on, all you want is maximum effort. Like, that's the way. Like, if a team just leaves it all on the floor, like, emotionally, it's easier to process a losing bet that way, as opposed to like betting on like the Phoenix Suns against the Wolves. Is just like, what the hell is this? With the Knicks, whatever happens, you just know that you are going to get, you know, all your pennies worth out of this team, because they are extremely admirable. The way they play.
Incredible, incredible offensive rebounding performance today for them, too.
It's again, and they just seem to do it almost every game. Not such an admirable series as Bucks Pacers, where Pacers have blown out the Bucks to go up 3-1. No Damian Lillard, no Giannis. Naturally, I don't think there's a great deal to say about this series. The one thing is that, like, Giannis seemed to be doing a lot physically on Sunday relative to what had been reported previous days. If he comes back, this Pacers team sucks. Like, they're just not good, not good at all. And I kind of think that Giannis could beat them three times by himself, because this Pacers team, there's a lot of, like, Shepherd, there's a lot of Nembhard at end of games, a lot of Aaron Nesmith, who's not, I mean, he's fine, but he's not really, you know, a guy who should be featured in the second round of the playoffs, which is where the Pacers are likely headed. But outside of that, like, I think the Pacers, if they do progress, which is very likely, I think they're just going to get stomped by the Knicks or the Sixers.
Yeah, can we send both these teams home and just replay Sixers Knicks next round? Is that not allowed? Probably not. No, I'm with you. The Pacers are I agree with you. If Giannis comes back and he looks anything like he did through the balance of February, March, where he was the best player in the league, I would say that the Pacers are not, they're not through. And that said, I don't know that I don't know that I believe much in these Bucks. Like, they don't play hard. They're not well coached. They're now going to have to win in seven. And I'm just not, I'm not seeing the obvious advantages from them. Like, game three was kind of the high point for this series, right? It was the most entertaining playoff game we've had so far, probably, just from the drama of the regulation and then overtime one. And they were making absurd shots. Was, you know, Chris Middleton banking in threes, no business going in. Like, it felt last gaspy to me from the Bucks, and then out of that game to learn that Dame Lillard is dealing with an Achilles also is a problem, and don't expect he will be back. If he does come back, it'll probably be game seven. And I think the Pacers, they just need one kind of good game and one Bucks ready to quit, and then, you know, they get through. And that may happen in game five, it may happen in game six, but I don't really know what to shine a light on here for the Bucks. Like, this is,
it's not a real team at the moment.
No. One of our friends had a funny comment today where he was like, are they going to have to, you know, go to the waiver wire to figure out a starting five for game five here? Like, you know, what are we doing? It's not a good situation at all. And, I hate to be this reductive about them when they're not even eliminated yet, but, we called it out at the time. I'm 9,000,000% sure we did. Like, this was a high risk bet that you had. And it was a must win now bet that they made, bringing Lillard in to team him with Giannis, and for it to flame out in round one is amazing. It's injuries are tough to overcome sometimes when they're with your key players. But this is a flawed team in every way, shape, and form. And I don't know, at this point, I'm not inclined to get involved with Bucks series unless we see some much more encouraging news about Giannis's availability. I think best case scenario for us is that the Pacers come through with an exclamation point, and then the market overrates them against the Knicks. What do you think?
Yeah, it'd be great.
Is there any chance of that?
Maybe Halliburton can just go back to the guy that he was in November and beat the Knicks by himself. But, you know, that's seems like a low percentage chance at this point. This Pacers team, they just don't have very good players overall, like relative to a team that wins a playoff round. And this Bucks team right now, like some of the guys running around tonight, it's like the roster and rotation of when it's like late March and you're on a back-to-back and you've sit all the vets and it's like, oh, let's just throw a game against the Hornets because we don't care about seeding. It's like, what? These guys are trying to keep the season alive. It's like running offense through AJ Green and Beauchamp and these types. Anyway, this Sunday, Liverpool and Tottenham face off in a must-win match. As time is running out on the Premier League season, can the Reds keep pace atop the table? Probably not. Can the Spurs make a late push into the top four? Probably not. Find out at 11:30 a.m. Eastern, exclusively on Peacock.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn on what you want, like trying out that new workout class, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like a foam roller for your sore muscles. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
All right, let's race through these game fours, the Monday ones. Lakers at Nuggets. Nuggets, 7.5-point favorites. Total 216.5. I think the most interesting thing here is Jamal Murray popping up on the injury report.
Yeah, absolutely. And following that very closely, because the angle that I like the most here is Nuggets team total over. I still haven't seen any evidence that the Lakers have solved end game situational defense against this Nuggets team if Murray is on the floor. And if he plays in this game, which I think he will, I'm gonna bet some Nuggets team total over. I think this is, I don't know, nothing that I saw from the Lakers really moved me that this is all of a sudden going to become a series.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, if Murray is out and if this calf is a real thing, then it gets interesting. But until that point, it doesn't satisfy the interesting threshold, I think. I think the Nuggets should roll. The Thunder should also, well, they're going to roll in the series. As to whether they roll in game four, they are 4.5-point favorites. In New Orleans, total is 204.5. Any bets on this game?
Yes, I like Thunder. I like Pelicans team total under. And honestly, just the Thunder defense in this series has been eye-opening. It's been revelatory, Jay. Like, these guys are so good, and they're so well coached, and they know their assignments so well, and they are just making life absolute living hell for this Pelicans backcourt. It seems like they are like specifically dictating, Pelicans, do this. We know you're not good at it. And it's incredible to watch. And I think the Thunder probably win this game going away. And I think I don't think the Pelicans are going to be sniffing 100 points here.
Yep. Okay. Last one. The leadoff event, Celtics, 10.5-point favorites at Miami, total a lowly 203.5. Yeah. Celtics are minus 10,000. Is that 10,000 minus 100,000? No, it's minus 10,000 to win the series, which they surely will do. Although if they'd lost game three, it would have been hell on earth in terms of content. It would have been quite a game four, but they didn't. They rolled the Heat. Here's the funny thing. Like, if the Celtics were to lose this game and the series is tied 2-2 going back to Boston, they're still like minus 1,100 in the series, right? Like, it's still to win 2 out of 3 when you're going to be a double-digit favorite in all three. But do you have any opinion as to whether they cover?
Let me see here. So I'm putting my numbers in right now. If it's 2-2, I would make Celtics minus 4,000. But that said, gird your loins, Jay. I think this is a bet on the Heat. I think 10.5 is too many. There was some interesting parts of game two on the rewatch that I didn't catch on the initial watch, and hat tip to Zach Lowe for pointing out specifically the way that Eric Spoelstra was using his defensive assignments to kind of force the action through Jaylen Brown, who is not, you know, the Celtics. And we can, you know, we're going to have to reckon with this at some point during these playoffs. It's probably not going to be in the Eastern Conference playoffs, but we're going to have to reckon with it at some point. Everyone besides Derek White, they're just beautiful basketball idiots out there. And they don't really have the off-ball stuff. It is not always making sense. And, you know, in particular, if you have a real deal defender on Derek White, things are clunky for this Boston offense. And I would expect that the Heat, who kind of put that in their back pocket in game three, are going to bring that back in game four, considering the stakes. And I think that's going to potentially cause problems for the Celtics, especially in the second half. So I think this is an underlook. And I think the Heat can stay inside 10.5. Ultimately, I think the Celtics are going to find a way to win, because the Celtics defense was incredible against the Heat. You know, like, just the little bit of, hey guys, close out on a 3-point shot. Don't just like let, you know, guys get hot and get comfortable shooting the ball. You know, like that one little attention to detail was hugely impactful, I thought, in game three for the Celtics defensively. And I think this is going to be probably an ugly game that ultimately the Celtics find a way to win and close this thing out in five, at least I hope. And I think, but I think the Heat can stay within 10.5. My fare on this one is closer to 8. And that is while at the same time just recognizing that the Celtics are just a much better team. 10.5 is a lot for a road favorite in a playoff environment with the, you know, with a coach like Spoelstra involved.
Yeah, I think with the Celtics, we're just not going to find out if they're any good until the finals. Not going to find out if all these issues have been fixed by having Drew and Porzingis until the finals, I think, because they're going to absolutely roll Cleveland or Orlando. And if the matchup is Knicks or Pacers, I love my Knicks. I love them dearly. I don't think they're going to trouble Boston. And they may steal. They'll probably, you know, do the Celtics-y thing and they'll steal game one or something. But I just like the Knicks have one guy on offense, really. And I just don't think that's going to fly against Boston. And, I mean, I would say that the modal outcome in that series is probably Boston 4-1, if that is the series. And then you get to the finals and then you'll find out, because they will have, you know, a serious opponent in the finals, whoever it is. I'm assuming it's going to be one of Denver, Minnesota, OKC or Dallas, unless Kawhi miraculously gets healthy. But that will be the true test at that point, a kind of Philadelphia Eagles type of run to the Super Bowl from a couple of years ago, where you get to beat the Daniel Jones Giants and then you get to beat Christian McCaffrey at quarterback. And then you get Patrick Mahomes and Nikola Jokic to get your crown. So hopefully the Celtics, it works out a little better for them than it did for the Eagles. And there's no Kadarius Toney holding a knife waiting for them in the finals, but we will see. All right, we are done. Don't forget to check out NBCSports.com for more information to help you with your wagers. Thanks to those of you watching on the NBC Sports YouTube channel. And if you're listening to us in podcast form, don't forget to rate and subscribe. Also a reminder to find all your favorite NBC Sports shows on Amazon Music. Just head to amazon.com/NBC Sports. From Jay Croucher and Drew Dinsick, we'll see you tomorrow.
You don't need a lot of money to do more with it. Join Padma Lakshmi, Viola Davis, and Fidelity's Women Talk Money Team during our free Women's History Month series, as we get real about ways you can start planning and saving for the future you want, so you can feel good about your money every step of the way. Save your seat today at fidelity.com/WHM. Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, member NYSE, SIPC.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn 2% cash rewards on what you want, like season tickets to watch your favorite team, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like paying for parking. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.